A note for listeners. This episode contains a story about an allegation of rape. Please listen with care.
This is a Crowd podcast.
Great God, this is an awful place. Those were the words of the explorer Robert Falcon Scott on his ill-fated expedition to the South Pole in 1912. Words that could also apply to Vostok, Russia's research station, which lies about 800 miles from the South Pole. This is where the world's lowest ever temperature was recorded, minus 89 degrees Celsius. Living there can cause headaches, vomiting, ear pains, nosebleeds, muscle pain, weight loss, and sudden rises in blood pressure. It is not an environment in which to lose your temper. One night at Vostok in 1959, two men had been playing chess long into the night. They were Russian scientists, both skilled players, and it was a good way to pass the time. At one stage, the men, who had been drinking, argued over a move. We're not sure what. But the game carried on. When it finished, the loser was angry. He went away and returned with an ice axe and murdered his opponent. To this day, Russians on the continent are banned from playing chess, although not from drinking. This was Antarctica's first known violent crime. But as I found out in the course of making this podcast, it was not its last. This series started out as an investigation into the death of Rodney Marks, but it's developed into something much bigger, a window into the darker side to life on the ice. In this episode, we're going to explore that, to look at a continent far removed from the image of science and exploration. You'll hear firsthand from women about a pervasive culture of sexual harassment. You'll hear how serious allegations of assault and violence have historically been dealt with and covered up. It turns out the death of Rodney Marks is but one example of an instinct to cover up potential crimes. I'm reminded of a phrase that someone once said to me when I went down to Scott and McMurdo bases in 2003. We were out on the ice, setting up our tents to spend the night outside, and my guide turned to me and said, "Stephen, Antarctica is the most beautiful place that is also trying to kill you." This is the secret history of Antarctica.
Hello, I'm Larry Palinkas. I have had a long-standing interest in the ways that people adapt to and succeed in extreme environments, such as one might find in the Antarctic, other polar regions, or even in outer space.
Larry is the authority on the psychological impact of living in Antarctica. Since the 1980s, he's been researching what life on the ice does to a person.
As a species, we're typically not adapted to it, either physically or socially.
The cold and darkness messes with what's known as our circadian rhythm.
A circadian rhythm refers to the body's biological clock. The more altered your sleep patterns are, the more likely you are to experience many of the symptoms of what is referred to as the winter over syndrome. And part of that includes increased levels of depression and irritability. The four most common symptoms include sleep deprivation, depression or feelings of sadness, irritability, and essentially a decline in cognitive functioning. If humans hibernated, the kinds of symptoms that they might exhibit when they were hibernating. Oftentimes it's referred to the 20-foot stare in the 10-foot room. You know, people will be sitting at a table, engaged in discussion, and suddenly they will zone out, only to re-engage at a later point in time, completely oblivious to what just went on.
We heard Gene refer to this in the first episode. He called it the thousand-yard stare.
So someone could wave their hands in front of your face and there's no recognition that you're there.
My research found that anywhere from 40 to 60% of people who spend the winter in the Antarctic will experience this cluster of symptoms at some point during the winter. But the extent to which they become clinically relevant, to the degree that they require intervention of some form, either medication or therapy, is much less. Typically, about 5% of a population of a winter over crew.
So 5% of a winter over at the South Pole need therapy as a result of their experience?
Therapy or medication.
So I've actually been to McMurdo and Scott in the summer, which were just fabulous experiences. If you were assessing me, my suitability to go to Scott for the winter over for 6 months, what kind of qualities would you be looking at? What kind of questions might you ask me?
One of the things that I often pay particular attention to are people who I refer to as socially adept introverts. And by that, I mean they don't exhibit a need for social interaction, engagement with other people, but they're also mindful of the needs of others and respectful of those needs.
Aren't scientists kind of as a class, I guess, different than the norm, like people who study these things obsessively? So how do you separate that from their suitability to go down there?
Well, it's certainly not just the scientists. There was a phrase that I often heard at the South Pole, which sort of described the mentality of polar expeditioners, which was, we're all here because we're not all there. And it sort of reflected that it really did take somebody who was not necessarily, within the norm of people with, you know, typical hopes and ambitions and expectations about their daily lives. They exhibit an openness to experience so that they're willing to accept those challenges, and they possess the skills necessary to overcome those challenges.
Is it fair to say that if somebody was there with negative character traits, which could potentially cause trouble, these traits would be exacerbated by excessive consumption of alcohol, would they not?
Yes, that tends to happen in pretty much every environment. The difference in Antarctica, of course, is that alcohol is often used for recreational purposes as well as to deal with the stress of isolation and confinement. And it certainly contributes to social tension and conflict.
Over the years, there have been attempts to control alcohol use on some Antarctic stations, but they failed. For a time, staff at Amundsen Scott Base had a still where they distilled their own hooch, known as toast juice. They called it getting toasty. At the time Rodney was there, booze was a problem.
The alcohol use was excessive, and I was very afraid that we would end up losing somebody due to alcohol intoxication.
Dr. Ron Szymanski, we met him in the last episode. He was the doctor at the South Pole the year after Rodney Marks was there, in 2001.
He would do what I called competition drinking, where they would line up drinks of tequila on the bar and see who could drink the most shots. I would say alcohol was my biggest problem down there.
Yeah, there were probably quite a few people there that were alcoholics.
That's Gene. In a previous episode, we heard from Gene how he and his fellow South Polers had been asked to fill out a form before heading down. It was an order form of sorts. You wrote down what sort of alcohol you wanted for the winter and how much. So the supply was pretty much endless.
It's not surprising. I mean, you take any group of people and you put them in the middle of nowhere for a while, but you provide them with alcohol. I mean, those that drink will drink and probably drink more than they normally drink.
That was over 20 years ago, but it seems not much has changed since then. We've spoken with doctors who worked in Antarctica in recent years. They all listed alcohol as a practically insurmountable challenge. One of them told us, the more you try to squash it, the worse it gets. There's a book by the writer Julian Sancton, which retells the story of a doomed 1897 Belgian expedition to the South Pole. This was the first in what was known as the heroic age of Antarctic exploration, before Roald Amundsen from Norway finally reached the pole in 1911. The Belgians' ship, the Belgica, got stuck in the ice. The crew was forced to spend the winter there. Illness ravaged those on board. And in the endless polar night, they slowly descended into insanity. The book's title is Madhouse at the End of the Earth. It's a fitting description.
A guy started approaching from the rear, and I noticed he had a hammer in his hand.
We heard the start of this story right at the beginning of the series. It's Dave's first day at the American base, McMurdo.
And then he proceeded to lunge forward with the hammer and strike the guy in the head. And then he fell on the floor and he swung at him again. My thoughts were, this guy is going to kill this other guy and I've got to get him out of here or it's not going to be a good situation. He pulled his arm over my shoulder and we snaked through the cafeteria seating area. And I was yelling in his ear the whole time, saying, you got to help me. I can't drag you this whole way. This guy's going to kill you. Let's go. And I could see the guy with the hammer coming towards us. So I went out the first set of doors, went to the second set of doors, set him outside, and I pointed to the medical facility and told him to run to the medical and go inside and lock the door.
The man with the hammer starts to chase Dave through the corridors before he realizes he no longer has the injured man with him.
So he went basically back to the housing office where he had borrowed the hammer and turned it back in as if he was just done using it and then started wandering around the hallways. So, yeah, that was my first day in Antarctica. It was a little feeling of I'm in over my head and these people are crazy. What the hell did I do?
Eventually, the FBI arrive. The man with the hammer is sedated and put in a straitjacket. He'd been drinking the night before, and it seemed there'd been a long-standing tension between the two men.
So obviously they had some kind of quarrel over the winter, and they were teasing him incessantly, so obviously it pushed him over the edge eventually.
Do you think there's enough psychological screening of people before they go down? And as a follow-up question, has that changed over the years? Is there more screening now or not?
Actually, the level of screening has diminished over the years.
I'm back with Larry, the psychology expert. He says screening of new recruits used to be pretty thorough, but that changed in the 1980s.
Both due to budget cuts as well as a diminished, or at least perceived diminished need for psychological screening and selection. Rather than have an interview with a psychologist or psychiatrist, a medical record was for the most part relied upon in determining whether somebody was eligible and suitable for an assignment like that.
They're looking for loners with long fuses, as one journalist put it. But sometimes, people who are perhaps less well-suited to a life on the ice, a sore loser at a game of chess, for example, can slip through the net. Antarctica has a long history of these kinds of stories. One year, an entire station was burnt to the ground because the staff didn't want to stay another winter. Or, just a few years ago, a Russian engineer was charged with attempted murder after stabbing his friend multiple times. The attack was allegedly about the man repeatedly spoiling endings of books, that the engineer had taken from the station library. Reading was one of the few forms of entertainment. That station had one state TV satellite channel and a shaky internet connection. Reports also suggest alcohol was involved. As we're about to find out, when something goes wrong, Antarctic authorities who are supposed to investigate can display shocking incompetence. I'm going to begin with a general question about women in Antarctica. It's late 2023, and I'm speaking with a woman called Jennifer. And a quote, a very interesting quote I found from a biologist called Rita Matthews, who went to Antarctica in the 70s. Jennifer's worked in Antarctica a number of times, and she's got a story that reveals a lot about the treatment of women on the ice. And she talked about this culture of women on the base, of treating women on the base. She described a wolf pack mentality and people she called predators. And yeah, it paints a pretty grim picture of what it might be like for a woman down on one of these bases. Do you think anything has changed?
Oof, yeah, I've heard stories about how things were for women, especially, you know, long before I came on board, about, you know, oh, don't go into this cabin because you'll get raped if you go in there. And it with me, it wasn't that explicit. And, you know, it unfortunately didn't dawn on me just how rough the situation was until I myself was raped. And then I realized not so much that there were explicit threats, but there was such a dearth of support in terms of where I could go for help.
Jennifer was working at a catering company back home when a job opening popped up for a dining assistant at an Antarctic base. Someone to help out in the galley, the kitchen, and to clean.
It was definitely one of those why not opportunities. You know, how many people get to go to the bottom of the world and, you know, see penguins in their natural habitats and orcas and seals and be able to go on hikes and see, you know, how far humanity can go.
It was her first time on the ice. A keen photographer, she films everything.
Holy crap, I'm actually here. Antarctica exists and I'm getting off this giant plane and look at all these people and, you know, they're kind of smirking at me because, you know, you could probably tell from a mile away that I was a newbie. You know, an FNG, our fucking new guy.
Jennifer notices the long-timers, those who've spent longer than others on the ice.
They just move super slowly, and when you talk to them, you kind of have to give them a several-second delay in terms of for them to be able to generate a response, and, you know, just because things take that much longer to kind of absorb into your brain after a while.
Jennifer's been working at the base for a few months. When something happens to her that for many years she didn't talk to anyone about. It's a story that reveals a lot about how alleged crimes are dealt with in Antarctica. A few weeks into the job, she meets someone. It was an encounter that would change her life.
Things suddenly changed and it became a life-changing incident and it left me torn and physically ill.
In the days after, Jennifer thinks about her options, but she soon realizes she doesn't really have any. There was a complete absence of support at the station, she says. She didn't know who to tell about what had happened, nor what resources were available to her. They'd received brief harassment training at the start of the season, but it was very surface level, Jennifer says, and posed as a hypothetical, as if they wouldn't need it anyway.
You know, there was no advocates on station that could, you know, look out for my needs and protection. There was no jail to protect me from my rapist or for any harasser for that matter. To my knowledge, I didn't even know at the time that there were rape collection kits in the medical facility.
Rape collection kits contain everything you need to preserve evidence,
so that they can put a physical case together in terms of knowing for certain who committed this rape.
These kits are vital for building a strong case against your alleged attacker, should it ever reach the courts.
And in fact, I was talking to someone in the Antarctic Fire Department who they themselves did not know until the last couple of years that there were rape kits that existed, which kind of blew my mind because the Antarctic Fire Department is the group that is always the first responders in emergencies like sexual assaults.
With nobody to turn to, Jennifer puts her head down. If her colleagues find out what happened, she's worried it might backfire, and she would be blamed. In such a close-knit community, rumors can spread like wildfire.
My brain, you know, being a trauma survivor, my brain sort of pulled the most generous disappearing trick for me that it had in its disposal, and it's something that I now know was traumatic amnesia. I did not recall the rape for nearly a year. I, you know, did what I had to do to get through the rest of my season, and that was that.
Jennifer is one of the few women to speak out publicly, but her story is far from unique. The predators, scavengers, and a wolf pack mentality that the biologist Rita Matthews found in the 1970s still persists today. An independent review in 2022 concluded that Antarctica has an ongoing and pervasive culture of stalking, sexual harassment, and sexual assault. 59% of women said they'd been sexually harassed or assaulted on the ice. One woman who's quoted in the report says it's a fact of life, just like the fact that Antarctica is cold and the wind blows. "You're a wanted resource," another woman told us. Someone else told us that when you're down there, surrounded by 6 million square miles of ice, reporting an attack or an assault to the authorities back home is a big deal. "Everything's inward-looking," she said. "Your world is the station. So to call out if something bad happens, there's a psychological barrier to doing that." But even for those who do come forward, like Jennifer, when it comes to getting justice, she's about to find out she's in the worst possible position she could be in.
I decided not just standing up for myself, but standing up for other people that might have been harmed by my rapist was enough of a reason for me to come forward and start talking about this openly.
She writes an email to the HR departments of various companies in charge of employment and operations on the ice, including the man's direct employer. She waits, and a few days later a reply lands in her inbox. They'd already finished the investigation into her case, they say.
And they came to the conclusion that I was not the victim of sexual assault, but merely sexual harassment. However, they did decide to rescind the contract for my rapist for the upcoming season, and he would not be allowed to come work in Antarctica again. And I thought that would be simply the end of it.
So just to recap then, you report a rape. And on the basis of email exchanges only, this corporation and its HR people get together and decide there hasn't been a rape. It's just a harassment without doing any actual investigation.
Right. They told me that my experience was a sexual incident that provided you great humiliation. I don't remember the exact words, but basically they said it was a humiliating sexual experience for me. And there's definitely a difference between humiliating and, you know, being raped, because I understand what sexual harassment is, and this wasn't mere sexual harassment. This is the worst thing that could possibly happen to someone, certainly a woman.
The years pass. Jennifer tries to move on with her life. But one day in 2020, she's talking with a friend who she used to work with in the galley. This friend tells her about a first-year dining attendant at an American base who's just come forward with her own story of being raped.
When she came forward, she was essentially told to talk it out with her perpetrator, and then she was fired.
To make things worse, in 2022, a spokesperson for the company in charge of American polar operations stood before Congress in sworn testimony and made a shocking claim. They said there had been, quote, zero allegations of sexual assault at the research stations between May 2017 and April 2022. But how can that be possible? The two women we've heard about in this episode both came forward during that exact time frame. The claim caused such outrage, the House of Representatives wrote a letter to the company in question, saying the claim was demonstrably untrue. They wrote, "Any efforts to purposefully provide inaccurate information to Congress and to obstruct the investigation into this matter cannot be allowed."
Until we have companies that are not going to dig their heels and not going to deny reality and just how pervasive this problem is, nothing is ever going to change, and we're not going to get any semblance of justice or resolution that we deserve. I want them and the world to know the name and the story of at least one person whose life was changed profoundly by their inaction and their hesitancy to create positive change.
The National Science Foundation is making some attempts at mitigation. Towards the end of last year, they announced they were banning alcohol sales in the bars at McMurdo, their biggest base. A spokesperson said, "We will not rest until we are confident that every member of the Antarctic community feels safe and supported." But Jennifer's skeptical. They know full well that all the rationing or denial of alcohol sales being forced on us isn't going to do a damn thing, she says. To this day, Jennifer's allegation stays just that, an allegation. She eventually found the courage to report the attack to the FBI. But they told her after months of waiting that there wasn't enough evidence to pursue it. Antarctica has a long-standing history of violence and crime in the shadows. But collecting evidence in a remote place shut off from the rest of the world, a land of no jurisdiction, is difficult. As we will see when our investigation into Rodney Mark's death unfolds. And so, as the year 2000 is nearing its end, we return to Rodney, whose body is lying in Christchurch. The pathologist has finished the autopsy. He's discovered a shocking cause of death that nobody had expected. Rodney was poisoned. Next time, who poisoned Rodney Marks?
There is a strong possibility that this was intentional.
If you pay attention at all and understand Antarctica and the stress peoples go through, you could see that there was a potential for something to happen.
The Secret History of Antarctica is a Crowd Network original. It's presented by me, Stephen Davis, and produced by Anna Stauffenberg. Mixing and sound design is by Rory Alskoy. The music we use is from our partners, BMG Production Music. Thanks to Luis Rodriguez at Sonic Space Lab Music for studio recording. To binge the whole series ad-free and for exclusive bonus episodes, subscribe to the Crowd Stories channel on the Apple Podcasts app. You can also listen ad-free on Amazon Music. If you haven't already, take a listen to the first two Secret History series. The Secret History of Flight 149 is the tale behind how a passenger plane got caught in a war zone, leaving hundreds of people at the mercy of Saddam Hussein. Hear from the human shields who were held hostage in Kuwait, and from those who've spent years searching for the truth. Series 2, The Secret History of the Estonia, is my investigation into what really happened when a passenger ferry sank in the Baltic, killing 852 people. A story of secrets, smugglers and spies that leads back to the Cold War. Find both those series on the same feed. Thanks for listening.
Crowd Network, a place where you belong.